It was weightlessly easy to walk out of her office and down the stretching halls of Taggart Transcontinental. She walked, looking ahead, her steps advancing with the unbroken, unhurried rhythm of finality. Her face was held level, and it had a look of astonishment, of acceptance, of repose. She walked across the concourse of the terminal. She saw the statue of Nathaniel Taggart, but she felt no pain from it and no reproach. Only the rising fullness of her love. Only the feeling that she was going to join him, not in death, but in that which had been his life. The first man to quit at Reardon Steel was Tom Colby, rolling mill foreman, head of the Reardon Steelworkers Union. For 10 years he had heard himself denounced throughout the country because his was a company union and because he had never engaged in a violent conflict with the management. This was true. No conflict had ever been necessary. Reardon paid a higher wage scale than any union scale in the country, for which he demanded, and got, the best labor force to be found anywhere. When Tom Colby told him that he was quitting, Reardon nodded without comment or question. "I won't work under these conditions myself," Colby added quietly, "and I won't help to keep the men working. They trust me. I won't be the Judas goat leading them to the stockyards." "What are you going to do for a living?" asked Reardon. "I've saved enough to last me for about a year. And after that," Colby shrugged. Reardon thought of the boy with the angry eyes, who mined coal at night as a criminal. He thought of all the dark roads, the alleys, the backyards of the country, where the best of the country's men would now exchange their services in jungle barter, in chance jobs, in unrecorded transactions. He thought of the end of that road. Tom Colby seemed to know what he was thinking. "You're on your way to end up right alongside of me, Mr. Reardon," he said. "Are you going to sign your brains over to them?"
"No."
"And after that?" Reardon shrugged. Colby's eyes watched him for a moment, pale, shrewd eyes and a furnace-tanned face with soot-engraved wrinkles. "They've been telling us for years that it's you against me, Mr. Reardon, but it isn't. It's Orrin Boyle and Fred Kinnon against you and me."
"I know it."
The wet nurse had never entered Reardon's office, as if sensing that that was a place he had no right to enter. He always waited to catch a glimpse of Reardon outside. The directive had attached him to his job, as the mill's official watchdog of over- or under-production. He stopped Reardon a few days later in an alley between the rows of open-hearth furnaces. There was an odd look of fierceness on the boy's face. "Mr. Reardon," he said, "I wanted to tell you that if you want to pour 10 times the quota of Reardon metal or steel or pig iron or anything, and bootleg it all over the place to anybody at any price, I want to tell you to go ahead. I'll fix it up. I'll juggle the books. I'll fake the reports. I'll get phony witnesses. I'll forge affidavits. I'll commit perjury. So you don't have to worry. There won't be any trouble."
"Now, why do you want to do that?" asked Reardon, smiling.
But his smile vanished when he heard the boy answer earnestly, "Because I want, for once, to do something moral."
"That's not the way to be moral," Reardon started, and stopped abruptly,
realizing that it was the way, the only way left. Realizing through how many twists of intellectual corruption upon corruption this boy had to struggle toward his momentous discovery. "I guess that's not the word," the boy said sheepishly. "I know it's a stuffy old-fashioned word. That's not what I meant. I meant..." There was a sudden, desperate cry of incredulous anger. "Mr. Reardon, they have no right to do it."
"What?"
"Take Reardon metal away from you."
Reardon smiled, and prompted by a desperate pity, said, "Forget it, non-absolute. There are no rights."
"I know there aren't, but I mean... what I mean is that they can't do it."
"Why not?" He could not help smiling.
"Mr. Reardon, don't sign the gift certificate. Don't sign it on principle."
"I won't sign it. But there aren't any principles."
"I know there aren't."
He was reciting it in full earnestness, with the honesty of a conscientious student.
"I know that everything is relative and that nobody can know anything and that reason is an illusion and that there isn't any reality. But I'm just talking about Reardon metal. Don't sign, Mr. Reardon. Morals are no morals. Principles are no principles. Just don't sign it. Because it isn't right."
No one else mentioned the directive in Reardon's presence. Silence was the new aspect about the mills. The men did not speak to him when he appeared in the workshops, and he noticed that they did not speak to one another. The personnel office received no formal resignations, but every other morning one or two men failed to appear and never appeared again. Inquiries at their homes found the homes abandoned and the men gone. The personnel office did not report these desertions as the directive required. Instead, Reardon began to see unfamiliar faces among the workers, the drawn, beaten faces of the long unemployed, and heard them addressed by the names of the men who had quit. He asked no questions. There was silence throughout the country. He did not know how many industrialists had retired and vanished on May 1st and 2nd, leaving their plants to be seized. He counted 10 among his own customers, including McNeil of the McNeil Car Foundry in Chicago. He had no way of learning about the others. No reports appeared in the newspapers. The front pages of the newspapers were suddenly full of stories about spring floods, traffic accidents, school picnics, and golden wedding anniversaries. There was silence in his own home. Lillian had departed on a vacation trip to Florida in mid-April. It had astonished him as an inexplicable whim. It was the first trip she had taken alone since their marriage. Philip avoided him with a look of panic. His mother stared at Reardon in reproachful bewilderment. She said nothing, but she kept bursting into tears in his presence, her manner suggesting that her tears were the most important aspect to consider in whatever disaster it was that she sensed approaching. On the morning of May 15th, he sat at the desk in his office above the spread of the mills and watched the colors of the smoke rising to the clear blue sky. There were spurts of transparent smoke, like waves of heat, invisible but for the structures that shivered behind them. There were streaks of red smoke and sluggish columns of yellow and light floating spirals of blue, and the thick, tight, swiftly pouring coils that looked like twisted bolts of satin, tinged a mother-of-pearl pink by the summer sun. The buzzer rang on his desk, and Miss Ives' voice said, "Dr. Floyd Ferris to see you without appointment, Mr. Reardon." In spite of its rigid formality, her tone conveyed the question, "Shall I throw him out?" There was a faint movement of astonishment in Reardon's face, barely above the line of indifference. He had not expected that particular emissary. He answered evenly, "Ask him to come in." Dr. Ferris did not smile as he walked toward Reardon's desk. He merely wore a look suggesting that Reardon knew full well that he had good reason to smile, and so he would abstain from the obvious. He sat down in front of the desk, not waiting for an invitation. He carried a briefcase, which he placed across his knees. He acted as if words were superfluous, since his reappearance in this office had made everything clear. Reardon sat watching him in patient silence. "Since the deadline for the signing of the National Gift Certificates expires tonight at midnight," said Dr. Ferris in the tone of a salesman extending a special courtesy to a customer, "I've come to obtain your signature, Mr. Reardon." He paused with an air of suggesting that the formula now called for an answer. "Go on," said Reardon. "I am listening." "Yes, I suppose I should explain," said Dr. Ferris, "that we wish to get your signature early in the day in order to announce the fact on a national news broadcast. Although the gift program has gone through quite smoothly, there are still a few stubborn individualists left who have failed to sign, small fry really, whose patents are of no crucial value. But we cannot let them remain unbound as a matter of principle, you understand. They are, we believe, waiting to follow your lead. You have a great popular following, Mr. Reardon, much greater than you suspected or knew how to use. Therefore, the announcement that you have signed will remove the last hopes of resistance, and by midnight we'll bring in the last signatures, thus completing the program on schedule." Reardon knew that of all possible speeches, this was the last Dr. Ferris would make if any doubt of his surrender remained in the man's mind. "Go on," said Reardon evenly. "You haven't finished. You know, as you have demonstrated at your trial, how important it is and why that we obtain all that property with the voluntary consent of the victims." Dr. Ferris opened his briefcase. "Here is the gift certificate, Mr. Reardon. We have filled it out, and all you have to do is to sign your name at the bottom." The piece of paper which he placed in front of Reardon looked like a small college diploma, with the text printed in old-fashioned script and the particulars inserted by typewriter. The thing stated that he, Henry Reardon, hereby transferred to the nation all rights to the metal alloy now known as Reardon metal, which would henceforth be manufactured by all who so desired, and which would bear the name of Miracle metal, chosen by the representatives of the people. Glancing at the paper, Reardon wondered whether it was a deliberate mockery of decency, or so low an estimate of their victim's intelligence, that it made the designers of this paper print the text across a faint drawing of the Statue of Liberty. His eyes moved slowly to Dr. Ferris's face.
"You would not have come here," he said, "unless you had some extraordinary kind of blackjack to use on me. What is it?"
"Of course," said Dr. Ferris. "I would expect you to understand that. That is why no lengthy explanations are necessary." He opened his briefcase. "Do you wish to see my blackjack? I have brought a few samples."